court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. We're on our third and final case for the March calendar, and it is 02-3380, State Ex Rel Michael J. Thorson versus David H. Schwartz. Appearing for Thorson is Jeffrey E. Olson, Assistant State Public Defender.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Jeffrey Olson. I'm an Assistant State Public Defender, and I represent the petitioner in this case, Michael Thorson. I'll go through the facts briefly. They're not really in dispute in this case, and then I'll move on to my legal argument. Mr. Thorson was convicted in 1991 of two crimes. One was second-degree sexual assault. The second was false imprisonment. He was given a total sentence of 13 years. In April of 2000, he had reached his mandatory release date, but instead of being released, the state filed a petition under Chapter 980 to try and commit him as a sexually violent person. At that point, he was transferred from the prison system, or the state prison he was in, I should say, to the Wisconsin Resource Center. And he was held at the Resource Center until his Chapter 980 trial in September of 2000. At that trial, the jury found that he was not committable, that he did not meet the criteria under Chapter 980, and so at that point he was released on parole. About 2 years later, a year and a half later, in April of 2002, the state began revocation proceedings for rule violations against him. I stress rule violations as opposed to a new criminal offense, because this is not a case where we have different criminal sentences, and trying to figure out what credit goes to which sentence. This is just a single sentence involved. He was ultimately revoked. The hearing examiner imposed 10 months of reincarceration, and at that point he asked for credit toward that 10 months of reincarceration for the 170 days that he had spent in the resource center while he was awaiting the Chapter 980 trial. And so the issue here today is whether he is entitled to that credit. And obviously, as a sentence credit case, this is governed by WSSTAT section 973.155.
I ask you, where does the 10 months come from?
The hearing examiner determined that amount. If you may note from the record, there's an exhibit attached to the petition for review, or for the petition for writ of certiorari. That's record document 1, page 4, I'm sorry, page 7, is the hearing examiner's decision. And in that decision, he lays out how much time is left on Mr. Thorson's sentence. And he can impose anything up to that time as reincarceration. The Department of Corrections had actually recommended reincarceration for longer, I think around 2.5 years, but the hearing examiner decided 10 months was appropriate given how well he had done in other respects while on supervision. So that's where the 10 months came.
Mr. Olson, didn't he actually face the possibility of something in excess of 4 years?
Right. He was looking at – he had over 4 years left on his sentence. I think it was 4 years, 3 months, and 8 days or something like that. So they could have given him up to that amount, but the hearing examiner said 10 months. Again, since this is a sentence credit case, we need to look to the statute with stat section 973.155, and that has two basic requirements in order to grant a person sentence credit. The first, of course, is that the person was in custody. The second is that that custody was in connection with the course of conduct for which a sentence was imposed. Mr. Thorson asserts that he meets both of those criteria in this case. I'll turn to the first one, which is custody. And the first point under custody is that the state and Mr. Thorson are in agreement on one thing. Mr. Thorson was in custody as that is defined under the escape statute, 946.42, paragraph 1A.
Which section does he fall under within there? Do you have the statute, Counselor, and can you point me to it?
Sure. He was in my position is, and I believe the state agrees with this, they don't explicitly say why they concede this point, but my position is he was in actual custody of an institution. And I laid that out in the brief. He's in actual custody because of an institution, because the resource center is denominated a state prison under the statutes. It's administered by the Department of Health and Family Services as a correctional institution, and it's actually staffed by employees of the Department of Corrections. It's a secure facility. It's got the automated doors and bars and razor wire, the whole works. And it's the same, it's custody that's factually indistinguishable from somebody who's sitting in the county jail awaiting trial on a charge. In fact, it's probably even more secure than a lot of county jails. So that is why I say he meets the definition of custody.
Right, Counsel?
Yes.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Did you finish?
Yes, I'm finished.
Under the Magnuson case, which the state talks about, they're saying he does not qualify. And I had, and then I lost the page where you had addressed Magnuson. But it appears if his, and you're emphasizing where he is, where he was at the resource center, at bars and gates. But is the issue that for purposes of sentence credit, an offender's status constitutes custody whenever he is subject to escape charge for leaving that status? And then on pages 12 and 13, this is of the state's brief, they go through how your client got there. And they end up, or I shouldn't say end up, but on page 13, they say none of the circumstances really apply to Thorson, because had he absconded, he would not have found himself subject to prosecution under subsection Pren 2, Pren A, and Pren 2, Pren B, nor would he have found himself subject to the to prosecution under subsection Pren 3A and Pren 3G, through G. Now, and those are all outlined there.
Right.
Just, what is your response to that? Because you do talk about it, but I'd like to know why you think that Magnuson would not apply. And I notice you emphasized the locking the gates, the confinement that he was in.
I have two responses to that. The first is that Magnuson does not, or at least should not, require that a person who meets the definition of custody in the escape statute also be liable for an escape charge under subsections 2 or 3. That's my first response. The second response is that if that is a requirement, then Mr. Thorson was subject to an escape charge under subsection 3A of the escape statute. If I can amplify my first response, I understand in the state cites, and I acknowledge in the brief, that there are several passages in Magnuson that say in order to be in custody for purposes of sentence credit, you have to be subject to an escape charge for leaving that status. But again, I don't think Magnuson really says that, or at least if it does, it shouldn't. And the court, I'd ask the court to clarify what Magnuson means, or if I'm wrong about what Magnuson means, I would ask the court to modify Magnuson to say that it doesn't require an escape charge to get sentence credit if you meet the definition of custody. And I say that for a number of reasons. First, Magnuson dealt with a person who was out of an institution, who was on bail, had been released from jail on bail with various conditions, including electronic monitoring. The defendant in that case argued that under a previous case, State v. Collett, a court of appeals case from 1996, that the definition of custody was much broader than sort of previously denominated by the courts, in particular the cases starting with State v. Gilbert in 1983. And Magnuson obviously explicitly rejected the Collett test as being too amorphous, too much work for the trial courts, all kinds of fact-finding involved. And also, Collett really explicitly departed from the line of cases that limited the inquiry to the definition of custody. And I think probably what happened is something this court recognized in Magnuson, is that the legislature has continued to create new ways of people to be in custody. And there is an impetus, a good impetus, and for good reasons, the court wants to recognize that the legislature has created these alternative kinds of custody, and that those also may subject a person to sentence credit. What we have to remember is the sentence credit statute uses the word custody, not escape. The custody or the statute for sentence credit was read in pari materia with the escape statute because of that word. The court in Gilbert was, and the jury instruction committee that it followed, was looking for a definition of custody. That is the purpose, that is the subject matter of the two statutes that's in common, not escape. And the language of the statute requires just a focus on custody. While Magnuson talks about being subject to an escape charge, I think that was a part of function of the defendant's argument in Magnuson that because he was on electronic monitoring, and there were all these statutes out there that made it the crime of escape to leave that electronic monitoring, that therefore all electronic monitoring should be considered custody. And the court accepted that only up to a point and said only if the statute that you are under explicitly refers back to the escape statute are you in custody. Because that is an indication that the legislature has said, well, this kind of custody, this kind of status is so restrictive and so custodial that we're going to treat it like somebody who is in custody for purposes of the escape statute. And that's the link between the escape charge and custody for the sentence credit statute. My approach is that you start with the definition of custody, that just the way Gilbert did. For 15 years, roughly, until Collett, that was what the courts used. It gave consistent and relatively easy-to-apply results. And it will probably resolve the issue in a lot of cases, in the bulk of cases. In those cases where the legislature has come up with new kinds of custody, the court can continue to look at whether the legislature has allowed for an escape charge in those situations. In other words, if you don't fit the standard definition of custody under 946.42.1a, the next question would be, are you in a status under a statute that says, if you leave that status, we'll charge you with escape? That's a very rational, easy to apply, relatively bright line test. And I say relatively bright line because I don't know that you're ever going to get an absolute bright line test in these situations.
Wouldn't your position require us to either overrule Magnuson or to withdraw significant language from Magnuson?
I don't think so. I think because Magnuson was dealing with somebody who was clearly not under the traditional definition of custody under 946.42.1a. The court itself even said, I think it was in paragraph 26 of Magnuson, that we're modifying the definition to the extent that we modify the approach set forth in Gilbert in that we do not limit the inquiry to the definition of custody in 946.42.1a. Instead, we acknowledge the importance of reading statutes in pari materia and include for reference other statutory provisions in which the legislature has classified certain situations as restrictive and custodial by attaching escape charges for an unauthorized departure from these situations.
Don't you think this court was attempting to fashion a bright line rule?
It was, and I appreciate that. But The issue here is Mr. Thorson is clearly not covered under any of these home monitoring statutes or other statutes that say if you leave this status, you'll be subject to escape. If he's going to be in custody for purposes of sentence credit, and that requires that he be charged with escape, the only statute that would apply would be 946.42, subs 2 or 3. But the desire to formulate a bright-line rule isn't advanced by adding on an extra requirement that the person be subject to an escape charge under subs 2 or 3, because you still got to decide custody. If part of the bright-line rule, problem with the bright-line rule is that custody, as defined in the escape statute, says includes but is not limited to, that isn't resolved by then looking at the substantive provisions of the statute to decide whether they're subject to escape, because you don't even get to those until you've decided whether they're in custody. So adding a requirement that they also be subject to escape under subs 2 or 3 of the escape statute does not help clarify the bright line rule at all.
Well, don't you have another problem? At least the Court of Appeals thought that you did with 973.155, and that's the language about being in custody in connection with the course of conduct for which the sentence was imposed. Isn't there a rather a strong argument made by the state here that he was perhaps in custody, and the Court of Appeals doesn't decide custody,
right?
But perhaps he was in custody, but it wasn't in connection with the course of conduct for which the sentence was imposed that he was in custody, if he was in custody, because of the allegations that he was a sexual predator.
Right. Well, I'll address that, sure. To be in custody in connection with the course of conduct is going to basically have two elements. There's the connection element and the course of conduct. And the course of conduct element is, or course of conduct language has been defined by State v. Tuescher, or Teuscher, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, the Court of Appeals case that I cite. And that's very clear that it focuses on the same specific acts or offenses. In this case, there is one set, there are two crimes that were given one sentence, a consecutive sentence. That's it. There's no other acts in this case. There are no other offenses, no other crimes. There is only one course of conduct. The Chapter 980 evaluation doesn't change that fact. The Chapter 980 evaluation, or the petition, does not require new overt conduct by Mr. Thorson in order to justify its filing. Basically, the 980 case requires an evaluation in which those crimes, that same course of conduct, is evaluated through the prism of whether he has a mental disorder and whether that mental disorder is going to cause him to reoffend in the future. That means, from my point of view, that there's one course of conduct. So we've got the course of conduct. The next question is connection. And the cases that deal with connection, also cited in the briefs, are basically Beats and Beiersdorf and this court's case in State v. Floyd from 2000. And those make it clear that the connection has to be a factual connection. In other words, the custody must be based on the same set of facts. And there can't just be a procedural connection between two different set of facts. That's why, for instance, in Beiersdorf, where the defendant was on bail for a sexual assault charge and then picked up a bail jumping charge, he couldn't get credit toward the bail jumping or toward the sexual assault sentence for the bail jumping custody, because there was no factual connection between those. Here, what we have is the same set of facts, and the only difference is a procedural difference. It's a different procedure. There's a Chapter 980 petition that's been filed, which starts a Chapter 980 proceeding. But that proceeding is connected to that course of conduct, because without that course of conduct, there would be no 980 proceeding.
Well, wouldn't the state respond to that, and doesn't the state respond to that by saying the focus in the 980 proceeding is on the evaluation, and on the determination through that evaluation that there is a mental disorder. And then the focus moves to whether or not this is a person who, because of that mental disorder, has difficulty controlling his or her behavior and therefore poses a danger of sexual acting out, if you will, violent sexual conduct.
Certainly that's the focus of the Chapter 980 evaluation and the Chapter 980 process. But that does not sever the connection between the custody in the resource center and the course of conduct that's being evaluated to determine whether he's going to do this again. The best analogy, I think, as I thought about this case preparing for oral argument, this is not one I made very strongly, if at all, in my briefs, but I think the best analogy is somebody who is on parole or probation, and maybe they have a serious drug problem. They are continuing to use drugs while on the street. They get picked up and put in jail, and the agent puts a hold on them and says, look, you're violating all these rules about drug use. We're going to give you another chance, though. We're going to give you an alternative to revocation in the Drug Abuse Correctional Center. And you'll be there for 6 months to get treatment for your drug problem. And if you do that, we won't revoke you. You finish the program, we'll put you back out on paper on the street. Okay? So the person does that. And then a year later, after they finish the DAC program, they're revoked. Do they get credit for that time they were in DAC? Absolutely they do. Because it was custody in connection with the course of conduct that put them on probation and ultimately got them sentenced. Was the purpose of the time in DAC purely punitive or punishment for the original crime? No. The major part at that point was the defendant's rehabilitation, the chance to get treatment, as well as incapacitation to keep them out of the public and from harming the public while they're still struggling with the drug problem. But that's a very similar analogy here, I think. It's a separate process. If they actually start revocation and they ultimately switch it to an alternative to revocation, the court's case law is clear that a revocation proceeding is a separate civil action. And that points out that a new process, a Chapter 980 proceeding, even though it is a separate proceeding from the criminal one, doesn't sever the fundamental requirement of the sentence credit statute, which is custody in connection with the course of conduct for which sentence was imposed. And that's exactly what Mr. Thorson had. He was in the resource center for the same conduct that got him the 13-year sentence back in 1991. And because that connection between those criminal acts and his being in the resource center, he has satisfied the connection requirement for the sentence credit statute.
What is Mr. Thorson's status now?
Where is he now? He's in Sandridge right now, awaiting a trial on a new Chapter 980 petition. When his 10-month reincarceration time was complete, they filed a new petition.
Wait, it triggered that time period again for a 980 petition?
If you attribute this time period, the 170 days we're asking for here, and he goes to trial, he's scheduled for trial in May, and he's again found not to be a predator, yes, absolutely.
Maybe I'm not getting this, but the parole, when parole was revoked, and he's sentenced for 10 months.
Right.
Aren't you asking for credit against those 10 months?
Well, in this case, what would have to happen is it would have to reduce the time left on his sentence. In other words, say he had 4 years left on his sentence, and the hearing examiner used 10 months of that. So that gives him 3 years, 2 months left. So this 170 days would reduce that 3 years, 2 months.
Are those the facts, or is indeed he completed his sentence having been revoked on parole?
He hasn't completed his sentence because all that time he was out on parole is lost. It's as if he never served it. He begins his sentence again at the time of his 10-month reincarceration, or actually at the time of his being taken into custody at the beginning of revocation proceedings, he would do his 10 months, and then he would start parole all over again with whatever was left on his sentence.
Mr. Olson, wasn't he asking the administrative law judge for credit for the 170 days as against the 10 months?
Right, he was. But because that hasn't been, it wasn't granted, it's still got to be given at some point. Now, obviously, if he never is...
He's already spent 10 months in...
Yeah, so yeah, his 10 months is over.
So now you're asking that the 170 days go against the 3 years, whatever...
Whatever would be left. Now, it may be that this is never comes up again, because if he's acquitted again in the Chapter 980 trial and he's put back on parole, he may discharge without being revoked, and then all of this time is essentially... this current time would essentially not matter one way or the other.
When parole is revoked this way, that makes him eligible for a 980. Suppose he had been on parole and hadn't been revoked. Did they still have a 980 potential on him?
No. Those have to be filed while when they're coming up to their release from custody of some sort.
No, it's a release for violating parole, and not for, is part of the original sentence. Okay.
Exactly.
Got it.
I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Christopher Wren, Assistant Attorney General, representing David H. Schwartz.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. My name is Christopher Wren. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the State of Wisconsin, and I'm appearing on behalf of the respondent, David Schwartz. Mr. Olson had not updated you on Mr. Thorson's status, I would have as well. The State filed a petition, this new petition, on January 15th. He's been at Sand Ridge or in one of these facilities since that time. So actually what's at issue here is not just the 17 days, or 170 days now, but this, roughly a year and a quarter at this point. He goes to trial on May 17th, so we're looking at close to perhaps a year and a half of additional credit if this court decides in his favor.
It will take a year and a half between the petition and the decision?
I don't know all the details of this. It's being prosecuted by one of my colleagues in the criminal litigation unit, Juan Colas. I did speak with him briefly yesterday. He told me it was supposed to go to trial last year, but then there was a request, I believe it was by Mr. Thorson, for a delay, and whatever the trial schedules are of the courts, I guess it wound up being May 17th. There was also a motion to dismiss that was originally granted to Mr. Thorson on a motion for reconsideration. The court, the circuit court, withdrew that dismissal decision, and it was just last Friday that they had the scheduling order in this that set it for May 17th. So there are a number of procedural things that went out that strung this out. But what it does mean is that we don't only have 170 days at issue here, but all this time that he has been in this, I guess it's Sandridge. I don't know if it was Sandridge the entire time, but for this, since from January 15th through May 17th.
In light of the fact that the state has kept him, do we agree he's in custody?
What I have tried to make clear is that we agree that he satisfies the custody definition of sub 1 sub A in 946.42.
Right.
But our reading of Magnuson is that that's a necessary but not sufficient condition for getting sentence credit. And if I could just introduce a terminology issue here, which I think is kind of important, because this is not a true sentence credit case. This is actually what the Department of Corrections calls a custody credit case. 973.155 strictly applies only to what happens at trial, at sentencing. This proceeding arises under revocation, which is under Section 302.11 sub 7 sub AM. That section incorporates 973.155, but refers to it solely as a credit, not as a sentence credit. If you look at the decision here, the hearing examiner's decision on revocation, you'll see that, and that's in the record at, it's in document 5 at page 85. It refers to the credit that's given to Mr. Thorson, who did get some credit for some parole time, parole hold time. It refers to it as a custody credit. And I just want to – this is kind of consistent with a court of appeals decision in State versus Edwards where it refers to confinement credit rather than sentence credit. And I think that just so that we're clear on that, this is not really a true sentence credit. It's custody credit. It's the same effect, but they do refer to it as custody credit within the Department of Corrections. And I'm sorry for that digression there. But.
Go ahead.
If you were to lose, does that affect in any way the state's ability to bring a 980 petition?
Does not affect the state's ability to bring that, bring a 980 petition, but it does yield some bizarre results. And that's where I think Mr. Thorson's argument is really problematic in terms of not only not just the language and the purpose of the sentence credit statute and the escape statute, but in terms of the relationship between Chapter 980 and the criminal justice system. The fundamental problem that I see with the argument in support of the detention credit is that there's functionally and conceptually no way to distinguish time spent in detention from time spent following an actual commitment. The result is, if Mr. Thorson's position, if this Court accepts Mr. Thorson's position, is that all Chapter 980 confinement, whether it's for detention or for commitment, winds up, in effect, being functionally an extension of a criminal sentence. And that will have the effect of integrating Chapter 980 into the underlying criminal proceeding in a way that the legislature has specifically attempted to preclude. It also means
you have to go slower on that. Why does it end up functionally being just an extension of the underlying
because if he's released, let's assume that it's not a situation where the jury, as in Mr. Thorson's case, says he's not a fit subject. It finds he is a fit subject. He's in treatment. He's been committed. Under Mr. Thorson's argument, so long as Mr. Thorson's argument is that the Chapter 980 proceeding, because the jurisdictional predicate for it is this offense, that anything that follows that, any confinement that follows that, whether it's Chapter 980 or whether it's a probation hold or whatever, is in relation to or in connection with that offense. That in connection relationship would hold not just through the detention period, but through the whole commitment period. And the result is that the longer you're into the commitment period, the more time has to be credited back on the criminal sentence. And as a result, Chapter 980 commitment by default becomes an offset against the criminal sentencing.
Hear him argue that. Are you saying he's in essence arguing that it's a credit against the criminal charge? Is that what he's arguing?
That's functionally what it amounts to.
Yeah.
Because he's asking for it to be credited against the time he has to serve on that underlying sentence. That's the only place the credit can go.
But, Counselor, why can't there be a bright line between before and after a determination in the Chapter 980 proceeding of sexually dangerous? If you look at what's before, you can connect it to his prior course of conduct, because but for that conduct, they wouldn't be detaining him, correct? But after the determination, if in fact the jury finds he is sexually dangerous, then he's detained because of that jury's finding, which relates to prospective conduct, not conduct that's already occurred.
But I think his argument is that it's always in connection with, because you don't get anywhere in that whole proceeding without it having some relation.
What I'm asking you as well, so that's his argument. What's wrong with our changing it just a bit and saying there's a difference before and after a determination under a Chapter 980 proceeding?
Because I don't see how, since the argument rests on the in relation or the in connection with, and the petition itself is based on a connection with plus the other stuff that happens.
Yes, but the adjudication is based on a finding that in the future someone will commit acts of sexual violence. Now, granted, you hear what they've done in the past, but you also hear a lot of other things in the course of such a proceeding. And the determination is not based on the fact that he broke a statute that prescribes that kind of conduct, but rather on his propensity to break such statutes in the future. So if you, but yet he's being held before the proceeding based solely on what he's already done. I know there's a probable cause determination, and so that kind of gets in the way a little bit of what I'm trying to suggest to you. But there has not been an adjudication that any other course of conduct warrants his confinement, except the adjudication that initially confined him in a criminal way.
I don't think that gives you the bright-line rule. I mean, he's been saying you don't have a bright-line rule now. I think you've got a much brighter line rule than with the requirement that it be subject to an escape charge than you do trying to finesse the question of this in-connection language with, because the connection isn't just it's basically, it would be, I might be able to accept his argument if the connection were solely in relation to the underlying conduct. But the petition, as well as the commitment, are in connection with this underlying conduct. And that's what his argument is about. The underlying conduct is what provides the connection. And that doesn't disappear once you go to the commitment. And I don't see any language in
Doesn't it disappear once you have an adjudication in Chapter 980?
Because the adjudication also requires the finding of that conviction.
It requires a finding of sexual dangerousness, though. Just the conviction is not sufficient to have a...
I understand that. And it's not sufficient for the petition either.
Okay.
I mean, in each instance, you've got a in connection with plus.
Yeah.
It's not merely a connection. It's not connection only with. His argument is it's just in connection with. If it said in connection only with, I don't think we'd even be here. But he's arguing a very expansive definition.
Very broad. I see what you're saying.
And so I don't see any way to distinguish that.
But why can't we distinguish it? I mean, we don't have to buy his argument.
I don't know. Well, maybe you can find some way of finding in connection with in one and not the other. But I don't think that the statutory language supports that kind of interpretation. I don't
think the adjudication makes a difference, even though you have to have more than a prior.
I don't think so. And I think it creates other problems in other areas. For instance, under his approach, Chapter 51 proceedings would become subject to sentence credit in cases where the Chapter 51 is tied into some kind of criminal conduct. Another example would be, suppose you had a person who
There's a difference about 51. 51, you don't need a baseline of a criminal sexual offense or any criminal offense.
No, you don't. But the language doesn't require that either of the sentence credit statute. It only requires in connection with.
How would you get a Chapter 51 in connection with a criminal sentence?
Well, Chapter 51, when it talks about dangerous conduct, and when I was doing these up in Barron County, we often had what was conduct that could be treated as criminal, that was the basis for the Chapter 51 commitment proceeding. And so if a prosecutor, for instance, decided to go forward with a corresponding criminal conviction, a commitment under Chapter 51 under this reasoning would wind up being an offset against any kind of sentence under
Chapter 51, though, doesn't come under 946.42(1) definition of custody, does it?
I agree.
Yeah.
It does. It's not a...
So he can't argue that because he can't get over
and neither
that.
Does and Chapter 980.
Well,
I mean,
he's making an
Chapter
argument.
Chapter 51 comes under it as much as a correspondent...
Well, yes or no. I mean, the language is secured correctional facility. Or secure detention facility.
Right. Well, it says any institution without limitation. And I know when we were committing people up in Rice Lake, we had people in Mendota. We had people over at Winnebago who were in confinement there. So you do put Chapter 51 people in those kinds of facilities. So my view is that under the 1A definition of custody, if it's not qualified by sub 2 and sub 3 under the escape statute, Chapter 51 would apply. Theoretically, I think if you had somebody who had been somebody who was not a citizen who had committed a crime in Wisconsin at the point at which he came up for release, INS placed a detainer on him, took him over and ran their hearing and decided not to let him, they didn't want to deport or expel that person. If that person comes back, the time in INS, under this broad definition of custody and in connection with, that person would become liable, would be subject to having the INS time credited against the sentence. I don't think the legislature intended that kind of application of fundamentally civil kinds of proceedings, civil kinds of commitments to offset the criminal time, the sentence time from the criminal conviction. I went through the escape statute the other day. I went through from the time it was enacted down to the time that, to the most recent amendments. The escape statute has probably been amended as much as maybe any statute other than the tax code in the state. There's no indication in there that the legislature intended escape to apply to civil-type proceedings, civil-type commitments, unless they specifically incorporated it. That's what in Magnuson, when the court refers to the various other statutes under chapters 302 and 303, I think it is, each one of those sections to which the court refers specifically identifies the offense or the violation as prosecutable under the escape statute. Chapter 980 doesn't have any kind of corresponding reference back.
Well, suppose the guy walks off while he's being detained, civilly detained.
Yes.
For a probable cause hearing. So he walks off. What are you going to charge him with?
Contempt of court. Disobeying a court order. That's all we have. And that's been our consistent advice to district attorneys. We believe it's a loophole in the law.
Yeah, I've had cases like that, escape from the county health care center, Chapter 51. Yeah. No, but I should say this. I've had a few escape while detained under Chapter 51, but never charged with anything.
Yes, there are certainly people that wander off that decide just they don't want to be there anymore, and that's certainly more true under Chapter 51, perhaps, where the facilities aren't necessarily as secure as those for people under Chapter 980. But the fact is, when they wandered off, the response was from the Corporation Counsel's office was to notify the sheriff, get an apprehension warrant of some sort, advise whichever county it was that we had the warrant, and ask him to pick him up, bring him back, and put him back in the detention or the commitment facility. But it never the escape was never something that was on the table because the escape statute doesn't provide for that.
A schizophrenic who's at the Marathon County Health Care Center and decides he wants out of there, I hardly think that that's criminal escape material.
Might not be, but I would agree. It didn't make sense to us to even contemplate that kind of thing. But when you look at the statute, there's nothing in the statute under the escape statute that would provide for Chapter 51. There's nothing, from my reading of it, in the escape statute that provides for the comparable civil kind of proceeding under Chapter 980 that wandering off or leaving a Chapter 980 detention or commitment would subject you to the escape statute. As I said, we believe that's a gap in the statute. I came across a report from another state. I don't remember which one it was. It might have been, I think it was Ohio, where some sheriff was utterly dumbfounded to find a similar kind of thing. Somebody had wandered off. They wanted a charge with escape, and they found that the statute didn't apply. And I said, that's my case. In fact, when this case first came up, I had thought that he was chargeable with escape and that therefore this was not going to, that this was kind of open and shut in his favor. And then I started looking around and I started asking around and I was told that at a time when this first arose several years ago, that they reached the same conclusion that it was not subject to escape. And I know we've got, the Attorney General has got some legislation, that is in the draft form, it's ready to be introduced, I don't know when it's going to happen, that will add Chapter 980 as a specific form of custody from which, absconding from which will result in the prosecution.
Then will he get sentence credit?
Well, that's the other issue. I mean, I think that under Magnuson, that's one of the issues that has been raised as to whether there needs to be a corresponding correction in 973.155 to preclude Chapter 980.
Yeah, but if they don't make that amendment and just bring in an under escape.
It strikes me, then we'd be arguing the language of in connection with at that point, whether the 980 is in connection with the underlying sentence. And our argument, I think, would still be the same as I'm making now. I'm personally urging them to fix 973-155 to eliminate that litigation issue. But I think it then becomes an issue that this court will then have to decide if it leaves open the question of whether in connection with qualifies Chapter 980 custody as custody for sentence credit purposes.
Here's a problem I have. The guy goes in, he revokes parole, he should get appropriate punishment, and he does. But before that, he's kept in for 170 days for the state to determine whether he's a Chapter 980, right?
Right.
And if he's a Chapter 980, does his sentence still last? The 4 years is still hanging over him?
Our view is that it does, yes.
Okay. So he goes in and he's got 170 days that he's sitting in what looks like a prison to me. Does it look like a prison to you?
Well, as I recall, the way the court described the facilities, and I think it was either Post or Carpenter, they're personnel from the corrections department, but they are not uniform. They're different characteristics. It is a secure facility.
Okay.
Whether
it's
you want to call
it a secure
prison
facility.
Or not.
So he's got 170 days in a secure facility. Now he's served his 10 months, as I understand it.
Right.
And the department will try again because he may have changed in those 10 months, right?
Possibly, yes.
I assume you have new evidence, otherwise you wouldn't bring in another charge that you've already lost. But anyway, that's my assumption.
I'm not litigating it, so I don't know.
Okay, that's my assumption. So now he's going to sit for how many days?
Well, he's been there since January 15th at least.
Or be until July?
Until May
17th. That's 6 months. Okay, 5 months roughly.
Well, actually, close to a year and a half. Because it was January 2003.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
I thought maybe Justice moved more quickly than that.
No comment.
I don't mean the Department of Justice. I meant Justice in capital letters.
We try to move quickly.
That's 1 year and a half, roughly. That's 360 plus 180, so we're close to 500, over 500,
yeah.
Plus 170. Now we're 670. That's a lot of months,
right,
and years that he's been behind some sort of bars, whether you call them correctional bars or Department of Health and Family Service bars. And the state says that he still owes you 3+ years under the criminal sentence.
Right. Yes.
Somehow, if you try and explain that to somebody, it doesn't seem right. It doesn't seem fair. And all of this extra time is because he committed a sex offense, for which he should not be forgiven, and I'm not urging that he doesn't deserve whatever he gets. But it was all tied to the fact that he committed a particular sexual offense, or offenses, by the statute. Doesn't it strike you as not quite justice, in big capital letters, that the state wants its 3 years plus more? I can argue the other way, and I will in a few minutes, but it just seems to me there's something the matter with that.
Well, I understand your concern.
You understand my pain. You feel my pain.
I feel your pain, yes. That's correct. But I also think that that's a pain that's directed to the legislature. I don't think that there's a constitutional. And I think that's where I don't think we've got a due process. I don't think we've got a constitutional unfairness here. There may be in some platonic sense an unfairness in the way this is handled, but that's not, that's an issue, I think, for the legislature to address. In this context, I think it's important to understand a couple of things. I think it's important that, and maybe this is something that has to be addressed to the public so that they understand it, and to the court as well. That what we've got here is that it's not just that conviction. It's in Mr. Thorson's case, he's actually got another qualifying conviction for Chapter 980. And the petitions are the principle, this conviction that he has now, this most recent one, serves two purposes. One is it's a predicate offense that can be used for the ultimate commitment. But it's also a jurisdictional question, because the petition has to be filed within the 90-day period before he's released from custody on the sentence itself. But in the petition itself, and Chapter 980 petitions do this, they refer to other violations that are also qualifying violations. So when he's committed, he's not necessarily committed solely, and the petition is not necessarily based solely on the current offense. It's based as much, if he's got more convictions, on additional convictions that would also be qualifying offenses. In Mr. Thorson's case, he has another qualifying conviction. And unfortunately, the petition's not part of this record. But I think if you were to look at it, you'd probably find it referenced there.
And that goes to the language in connection with.
That's part of the argument, yes. For his conviction in this case, it has a twofold purpose. It's jurisdictional, and it's also a predicate offense. But it's not necessarily the only predicate offense. And so for purposes of the in connection language, it's hard to say, you run the risk of getting back to your case-by-case analysis if you start saying, well, if he only has one predicate conviction, then it's in connection with. But if he has more than one predicate conviction, it's not in connection with, because there are other crimes that are involved in this thing that precede this particular conviction.
Counselor, are you talking about if he has other crimes for which he was incarcerated right before the Chapter 980, or are you talking about other crimes that he might have already served his sentence on and been concluded, and does it make any difference?
As I understand under Chapter 980, it wouldn't make any difference whether he's already served it or whether he's still serving that sentence.
No, I was wondering what you were talking about. Would it make any difference in your argument?
No, that would not make any difference to my argument. The issue is whether he has predicate The current offense serves as the jurisdictional predicate. The current offense and any other serve as evidence of future dangerousness, maybe even his mental status. Mm-hmm. So they serve multiple purposes.
But he wouldn't be in custody in connection with an offense for which he had already served his time and was done. He either has to be in custody for several things with Department of Corrections before he's done serving his criminal sentence, or the one that the custody is in connection with is just the only one he's serving sentence. Am I making myself?
Well, I think I understand. What you're driving with, okay. But I think that when it talks about in connection with, it doesn't necessarily say in connection with this current case. I mean,
well, it says
maybe I'm not making myself clear. But
well, yeah. The problem is the custody that you're in for when the Chapter 980 is filed can result from many acts. Okay. Or it can result from one act, right? But you could have had another act that you weren't in custody for at that time that might also be part of the petition.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And could also be part of the commitment. And so what?
Yes. Right.
So since you're in custody as a result of this petition, the petition is the only reason he's in custody.
Sure.
If the petition is alleging these other ones for which he's not, he's already served his time, which are also predicate offenses, arguably it's in connection with that as well.
I see your argument. You could argue it the other way, though, and say the only reason he's there is because of the predicate offense, because they had a file on that predicate offense, or they wouldn't have been timely under the statutes.
Right, but they might have used that predicate offense as the jurisdictional predicate.
Sure, right.
But would not have filed if he didn't have other convictions as well.
Right, but what I'm looking at is custody in connection with that lingo. And I think he's in the institution because of the crime that he was incarcerated for immediately before that as a criminal if you read it narrowly. Now, you can read it broadly and say, well, that's one of them, but that's not the only one, and I understand that.
Our reading is that the in connection with language, the bright line rule from our point of view is that the filing of the petition severs the connection. I mean, that's the bright line rule, that the filing breaks the connection and sends Mr. Thorson's custody off into a different track, into a civil track. It's not a continuation of the sentence that was imposed on him for
yeah, the... Yeah, but, you know, opposing counsel makes a good argument when he says when there's a revocation proceeding, that's civil too, and he'll get credit for being in custody during the hold.
For parole, and I believe
there's... Parole, yes, sorry.
Yeah, I believe there's specific authorization for that as well.
Yeah.
Which there is not for Chapter 980. I mean, if you go down, depending on how you want to look at the statutory intent, in each instance that this Court cited in Magnuson, there was a specific reference back from that other civil, quasi-civil, quasi-criminal statute to the escape statute. There's no reference back under Chapter 980.
Well, that's true, but just because it's not there, it doesn't mean the legislature didn't intend to give it to him. It may just mean they were careless or not as diligent as they might have been on cross-referencing all these statutes when they enacted the most recent provisions in 980.
Well, I think on something as serious as whether you're going to credit Chapter 980 confinement to or Chapter 980 custody to a...
I don't mean all of Chapter 980. I mean, I understand your point after conviction on a Chapter 980 proceeding. What troubles me is the time before, and particularly when you have someone that a jury has found not to fit the criteria of Chapter 980. So he was acquitted, essentially, on that petition, if you put it in those terms.
Well, and you run into similar thing on the criminal side. Somebody's acquitted, but they spent time
in
trial.
I know.
And they don't get credit either.
Yep. You're absolutely right, as long as they're
bound
over.
Which I think is perhaps maybe a more serious problem here, where... than here, where at least his custody follows on a probable cause determination.
But they're in a jail. Generally, they're not in a prison. They're in jail before they're convicted, right? So they're not really in the same kind of circumstance.
Well, for purpose of the escape statute and the custody statute and the sentence credit statute, I don't think there's functionally a difference between those two.
No, right.
So I wouldn't draw a distinction on that ground.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Wren, if Mr. Thorson prevails, we have to decide two issues.
Okay. I believe you. Yeah.
All right.
You mean under the sentence credit statute?
The custody and in connection with. We have to deal with two different issues if Mr. Thorson prevails.
Right.
All right. Suppose you prevail. What do you want the court to do?
Well, what we want the court to do is to obviously affirm the Court of Appeals decision. I think the Court of Appeals decision got it right. They focused on the in connection with language. We think that's right. But even if you accept his argument on in connection with, we think that he's also not subject to escape. So any one of those grounds, I think conceptually it's a lot easier. I think it's easier in a sense to deal with him not being subject to escape because when you deal with the escape statute and the way Magnuson is written, it's clear that the other examples that the court gave of custody situations subjecting a person to an escape charge all referred back to the escape statute. The sections 301.046 sub 6, 301.048 sub 5, and 302.4256, all of which were cited in Magnuson, all have specific references back to a specific subsection of the escape statute. And there are about nine other statutes that also subject a person to an escape charge by reference back to the escape statute. If you run the escape statute name, number, or the word escape through Westlaw or Lexis, you can find those statutes pretty easily. But we don't have any instance, as far as I know, of an escape charge being prosecutable against somebody in a shall we say custody situation, unless it's either specifically referenced in 946.42 or there's a reference in that statute back to 946.42. 980 does not have a reference back, and our position is that the one section that Mr. Thorson's relying on, which is sub 3 sub A, applies only to things that are going on during the criminal proceeding, and that there, to the extent that there's any in connection with, it's broken by the filing of that petition.
If I may. So it's your position under the legislation as it currently stands that if someone escapes while in the status of awaiting a 980 trial, the consequences are
contempt of court. You bring the person back under an apprehension warrant or an arrest warrant, whichever they use for DOC. I think it's an apprehension warrant, and the punishment is to take them before the court and a contempt of court proceeding of some sort, whatever the remedy is that the court would impose as a result of contempt. I mean, there's kind of an interesting point that there is a statute that criminalizes aiding an escape from mental institutions, which refers to escape, but in sort of a generic sense. But so it criminalizes somebody who helps somebody leave a mental institution, but it doesn't punish the person who does the leaving.
I have a question for you. So is it the state's position that he is, while he's being held for 980 before determination, that he's in custody as defined in 946.42(1A)?
I think we've conceded that given the broad language of the custody, of that custody definition in 1A, that he is in custody under that definition, but that for sentence credit purposes, that has to be further qualified by subject to prosecution under either 2 or sub 3 of that statute.
And you think that's required by the statute and by Magnuson?
Certainly required by Magnuson, yes.
Right.
And I think it's required by the statute, too, because you could have custody in that broad sense, but if it doesn't fit under one of those statutes,
well,
you try to prosecute, you're basically going for common law.
Why doesn't it fit under 3A? He's in custody pursuant to a legal arrest for, lawfully charged with, or convicted of, or sentenced for a crime.
Right. We've been arguing in our briefs about the breadth or narrowness of the meaning of pursuant to.
All right.
And I'll stand by my brief on the, that argument.
Good. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Olson.
Thank you. I think I'll start with the issue of custody and escape. Again, it's my position that Magnuson either doesn't or shouldn't require an escape charge in all instances. The court should look, or a court determining credit should start with the definition of custody under the escape statute. And again, the primary reason for that is the language of this sentence credit statute itself. It refers to custody. Gilbert and the cases following that read the escape definition together with that because it's custody. That's the subject. That's the subject of the credit statute, not escape. They're two different issues. The other reason to not require an escape charge in all cases for sentence credit is that it sets two competing principles on a sort of collision course. The case law in this court has been very clear that the purposes of the sentence credit statute are to afford fairness. The legislature adopted this the statute in the late 70s after this court's decision in State v. Klimas, and it's been noted many times that that statute is much broader than the common law right to credit or any of the case law before the statute was enacted. And as recently as State v. Floyd, this court relied on those very that purpose of providing fairness and about a liberal construction of the statute to find that a read-in charge, even though it was completely unconnected with the case in which the person was actually sentenced, because it was considered at sentencing, was related enough to the sentence to afford credit to the person. The court explicitly incorporated those broad principles of fairness in interpreting that statute. That's one sort of principle at stake. But if you incorporate or require an escape charge under the escape statute before there's custody, besides departing from the language of the statute, you're also bringing in a clashing principle that a criminal statute is supposed to be construed narrowly in favor of the defendant. So the construction of the various subsections under which a person could be charged with escape have to be construed narrowly. And you've created a tension between the purposes of the sentence credit statute and the rule of lenity for construing criminal statutes. And that especially shouldn't be done when the language of the credit statute refers only to custody, not to escape.
Counsel, I want you to address the argument that opposing counsel made that if we go along with what you're saying and interpret the sentence credit statute as the custody that he is currently under before the Chapter 980 proceedings are concluded is in the course of conduct for which sentence was imposed, that we will pick up any time someone's in custody before and after a 980 adjudication.
I have a couple of responses. And one is that as a practical matter, very few people are acquitted after 980 trials. And typically they spend a long time in the institutional care. And a lot of cases the sentence runs out while they're still in the resource center, or Sand Ridge now. And this all becomes essentially a non-issue because they're never revoked and there's never a question about using that for credit. Under the Department of Correction, the Department of Corrections keeps their parole running even though they're locked up in the 980 institution.
So they're giving them credit anyway.
Well, their street time or their parole time is running. But that's different from credit if they get revoked and sent back to prison. But the other thing is, and I want to take up a point Justice Rogensack made about the sort of the difference between detention pending the commitment trial and detention after the commitment trial. And I think that that finds a real strong analogy in precedent of this court, namely State v. Beats, where the person was on probation, picked up a new charge, was in jail simultaneously on a hold and bail for the new charge. And after probation was revoked and the person was sentenced, the court determined that custody now, even though it really arose out of the new burglary charges, and it was the new burglary charges that got the person revoked, that the connection between his custody and the burglary charges was severed by virtue of sentencing on the new on the prior case where he got probation. And that's very similar here. I think the court could fashion a rule that detention before the commitment trial is custody in connection, and that connection is severed upon the commitment because as in this case, as Mr. Wren was discussing, there are other predicate acts that from sentences that were long ago discharged. And and typically a 980 trial, as this court knows, goes into a bunch of other conduct that's not necessarily criminal or that he's not necessarily ever been charged with. And so I think that creates a sort of rational rule. And because Beats is a sentence credit case and involves the same statute we're interpreting here, I think the parallels are very strong.
Thank you.
I see my red light is on. If there are no more questions, so I will thank the court for its time and sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Olson, and thank you, Mr. Wren, for your arguments on sentencing credit. We haven't had a sentencing credit for a while, so it's interesting to be back in, even under a new guise. That concludes our discussion and hearing under 02-3380, State Ex Rel Michael J. Thorson versus David H. Schwartz. The court will reconvene in the conference room at 3:10.